Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy, sitting in for Father Matt Malone, who is on his way to the Boston College commencement. So congrats to all of the grads up there and all around the country this weekend and this month. We are talking about the news of the week before we transition to our discussion later with our guest. But first, we want to talk about this kind of a hot topic for us, the Girl Scouts. Surprisingly controversial subject in some quarters of the church. Specifically the relationship between the Girl Scouts and different dioceses around the country. This kind of comes up every so often. It did a couple weeks ago, where I believe it was the Bishop, Archbishop of Kansas City, who came out and said that he was discouraging Girl Scout troops, et cetera, from being formed and in Catholic schools and parishes. This caught some people by surprise. Turns out we have put together our Teresa Donnellan, one of our hair fellows, has put together this explainer, kind of going through the history of the Catholic Church and the Girl Scouts. So I brought this article to the table, but Carrie, were you a Girl Scout? Do you have some personal?
What would make you think that I was a Girl Scout? So I was a Brownie,
okay,
which is the baby Girl Scout. Not the there's daisies, there's Brownies,
yes,
there's Girl Scouts. I think that might be, there might be other things. There's, is there one more maybe above
that's
that?
That's funny, because there are no Girl Scouts in the UK.
Do you have something else though,
well,
right?
Well, I was a Brownie, then there are Girl Guides, which
girl
maybe
guides
are the same thing.
Yes,
the Girl Guides.
We will get into that. Okay. There is, that's part of the story.
Okay, Tim, I'm waiting. I'm on the edge of my seat.
So I was a Brownie, and we had a troop that was, in fact, associated with our parish and our Catholic school, and it was mostly kids from the school that also went to the parish that were in this group. And we were like Troop Beverly Hills, but not rich. Like, we were just inept. And
is
no
that a
one.
Movie?
It's less exciting, I think, if this storyline involves not rich people. But it was, no one wanted to be our guide, our troop leader. So my mom did it, and my mom honestly hates the outdoors. She hates animals. She does not like any of the things that you would imagine. And we did a lot of crafts. We were we're going apple picking, and here's your farming badge, But it was fun. We had fun, and I did it for a couple years. And then when it became, then you graduate and you become a Girl Scout, at which point there was a troop that existed, but the leader of the troop was really, really, really intense, which I imagine might appeal to some people. But she would be we'd be wheeling glitter in and out of ours on carts, and they would be wheeling encyclopedias in and out of their meetings. It was very much different tone and that we were used to, and I was I don't think I like the glitter version of the Girl Scouts, not the encyclopedia version. And I liked being outdoors and things like that, so I became a Girl Scout, and then I graduated. They give you a rainbow pin, or you go over a bridge or something like that. Yeah. I don't know if they still do that. They did that at the time, and then did not continue on.
So Girl Scouts USA is the organization in this country.
Yeah.
They're the one that obviously has these chapters all around the country, involved in the Girl Scout cookies, which everybody's very familiar with. Then there's this international group, the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts. And part of one of the points of contention with some church groups is what some people have suggested is support for from WAGS, as we'll call it, for some pro-choice.
With three Gs, just looks crazy on print.
GGS, for organizations like International Planned Parenthood, that promote reproductive rights. So this is the bone of contention. Now, that link is not been conclusively proven by any means. It's basically there's just been some materials found at meetings. So it's a very complex story. So I do recommend, if you want the full history, to go to our website and read it. But
AmericanMagazine.org.
Officially, they don't have a stance on these things.
No.
So the Girl Scouts of the U.S. don't, but then they are associated with groups that are more active in some of these things. And then I would imagine it varies from group to group, right? So you could go to one troop and find some of these materials, and you could go to the other troop and they might be praying the rosary or something, you know,
right.
like
right. Yeah. I mean, just as you said, one group
they might be
wheeling around an encyclopedia, and your group was wheeling around glitter. That type of variability
exactly.
is what
yeah.
some archdioceses
I imagine
comfortable with.
Others are most are somewhere between that, but yeah, it's very complicated, and because I know a lot of people who have really had really really positive experiences with the Girl Scouts, and possibly Girl Guides in the UK. Were you a Girl Guide?
I don't think I made the cut. I think my sister was a Girl Guide, and maybe I didn't. I don't think
Did
I made it.
Did you have to like audition to do it?
No, I think I just maybe my parents decided it wasn't worth it, if it or something. I'm not sure. I know that I really admired. I remember really admiring her uniform, thinking that she was really cool.
The patches are like the best part. Right. Mine were all hot glued to my sash, though. We didn't. My mom was like, "I'm not sewing these." So yeah, that again, an indication of our commitment.
Now, there is this alternative group, the American Heritage Girls, which was found in 1995, which is in some Catholic parishes.
And so, which grew really fast,
yes.
I think.
So basically, this was founded by a former Girl Scout troop leader who decided to form the group after they altered the Girl Scout promise in 1993 to make reference to God optional. So that was the core what caused the groups to split. So like how you talk about God. And
that's important.
Yeah.
And it is... I mean, it's an interesting, I understand the need for inclusivity, but it's an interesting logistical question where if you're all supposed to say like the Girl Scout pledge at the start of your meeting and it's 500 different versions of it, like, is that just sort of the nature of pluralism or is that kind of an odd and less unifying kind of thing for folks?
Yeah. So again, complex story. I don't think we've heard the end of this issue. I think it's going to come up. Basically, where it's been left is that it's, you know, each bishop can make his own decision as to whether or not he's going to allow or encourage the Girl Scouts to form troops in his diocese. So we've heard from one bishop, but it's also in many other dioceses where it's not an issue. So
yeah.
Again, this may be an example of what Pope Francis has spoken about. It's like, we don't need like a national policy on this. We can just allow the local...
There's a kind of subsidiary to it.
Yeah, the local leaders to make the decisions.
So. Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense, yeah. And it gives... Thinking back, it gives me much greater appreciation for the things that parents do for their children, that my mom would become our troop leader, knowing her interests and skill level at outdoorsy things.
Now, one point that was made by Teresa sitting right here, and she's not at the mic, but she wrote this story, and I think she made a very good point, which is that for somebody who went to Catholic schools, these kind of groups were very important bridges to girls who are not in Catholic schools, mm-hmm. or like when you go to college and you're meeting people. So it's like, okay, here we have some common ground. Like,
yeah.
Okay, we didn't all go to Catholic school, but you know, when you go to do Girl Scouts, it's something that many girls share.
Yeah, exactly. And because there are, and maybe this is where the challenge comes in, is that there's this idea of like unifying values in that. And so I guess if there are challenges about the unifying values, then that question of that unifying element is tough.
Yeah. So anyway, this story will continue. I'm sure we'll talk about it again. So
indeed. And for now, we can bring in our guest for the day. We have with us Jenna Boer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We are very glad to have you. So Jenna, you are featured in an article that I wrote.
We can leave now.
Jenna and I are just going to chat. So in the interest of full disclosure, it's called "The Church Doesn't Talk Enough About Postpartum Depression, and These Catholic Women Are Changing That." And Jenna is one of the Catholic women who is changing that for our church and our world. And so the article that is on our website at americamagazine.org features a number of women who have experienced postpartum depression after giving birth, sometimes after multiple births, and the challenges they had in finding support in their faith communities, the challenges they had in reconciling this illness with their own faith and their own perception of themselves, of Mary, of all of the many things that kind of factor into something like this. So I wonder if you could start talking a little bit about your own experience with trying to reconcile some of these things, and then we can go into later how you kind of did that.
Yeah, sure. So in regards to how to reconcile it with the faith component and how...
Yeah, well, maybe let's just start with, you know, your own experience of postpartum depression and anxiety.
Yep. So I had an interesting journey because I actually wasn't diagnosed until my daughter turned one. So the first year of my daughter's life, it was a very confusing time. I had a really horrific pregnancy and had a really big struggle with my employer in regards to, you know, what my life was going to look like once I came back from maternity leave. So once my daughter was born, you know, there was definitely a hormonal shift, but I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what that was. So kind of symptoms that I exhibited, they weren't extreme. I didn't want to kill myself or kill my baby. And unfortunately, those are the stories you hear as it relates to postpartum depression. But things such as having a flat affect, not being as engaged with friends, not wanting to really talk to family, or a little bit resentful towards, you know, people that I didn't feel like showed up for me during my pregnancy. But I didn't have the pep in my step that I always had. Mm-hmm. My personality was totally changed. So I was still very functional, and I think that was why I went undiagnosed for so long. But despite being functional, I was a different person.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people don't realize about something like this, is that they anticipate, like, if you are experiencing postpartum depression and anxiety, that you won't be, like, out in the world in any way. And yet you do often, for many people, they do continue to function on some level in many parts of their life.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the data out there is 1 in 10 women are diagnosed, but 66% go undiagnosed. So they actually do have either postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety.
Yeah, a lot of women feel like in the 2 weeks following birth, they generally call it the baby blues, which sounds like, which is an actual kind of term that people use to describe it, where it's like, this is overwhelming, this is exhausting, this is tiring, I feel like, you know, what am I doing? What have I gotten myself into? But then after about 2 weeks, that should start to lessen. And if it doesn't, that's when a lot of women start to fall into a depression or anxiety. And as you said, a lot of people don't seek help for it. And I think part of it is because there's a lot of pressure placed on women to be sort of all things to all people. So if you feel like you're not living up to one aspect of motherhood, or you're not enjoying the number of people who go, don't you just love every second of this? Oh, you should just, this is going to go by in a second. And you're like, oh my God, I wish it would just go by faster.
By in a second.
Yeah. and I speak also from experience, because I also experienced this, which sort of piqued my interest in writing about it and hearing from other women's experiences as well. So you were able to kind of channel your experience into a desire for change. Can mm-hmm. you talk a bit about that in the workplace?
Yeah, sure. So after the first year went by since my daughter's birth, I began to look at maternal mental health as a whole, and also what motherhood meant to society, and especially where mothers show up in regards to the workplace. So what I found was that and I was doing a lot of one-on-one coaching. I went back and got a coaching certification. I enrolled in graduate school for counseling. So I was doing all this mental health kind of academic work. And I was working a lot with women one-on-one that were either planning to start a family or were already mothers. And what I found was that, you know, the one-on-one work that we did was helpful and productive, but I was really just putting a Band-Aid on a larger problem. I was giving them coping skills to kind of get through their day, but we weren't solving anything. So that really led me to evaluate, where is the core problem and how am I going to fix that? So what I realized is that there were several patterns with the women I was working with one-on-one. And one of the biggest pattern that I noticed was increase in what's called work-family conflict, and the decision to return to work, how to manage that. Also, once they are back at work, the stress doesn't go away. In fact, it typically increases. So that was one area that I wanted to really delve into. And what I found was that there is a systemic issue within a corporation as regards to behaviors and how supervisors, managers, and even fellow colleagues view mothers in the workplace. And that's when I pivoted my company to really attack the core problem, instead of just kind of doing the Band-Aid solution.
And so, the pivot, you're leaving us hanging here. So what did you sort of turn to look at then instead?
Yeah, so what I was looking at was really, my company's mission is twofold. So one is to
It's called Babies on the Brain.
Babies on the Brain, yep. It's twofold. So one is to improve mental health for new moms. And the second is to increase female retention in the workforce. So it's actually quite timely. We've had a lot of cool things happen, a lot of awareness, especially, you know, just the defiant young girl down on Wall Street. There's a lot of fun things going on with recent publications. New York Times actually just came out, I think it was on Mother's Day, where the motherhood penalty is the main reason why we have a gender pay gap. And that was a really illuminating article. So what I did was this information's already out there. The data's out there. What I've been doing is I actually go into companies and I tell them essentially what they're doing wrong when it comes to keeping their female talent. And I look at it from building an inclusive family culture perspective instead of just slapping on policies.
Right. I think your work, one of the really important things that you're doing is acknowledging how mental health is affected by circumstantial factors mm-hmm. as well. So if someone may not even know that they're experiencing postpartum depression or anxiety and they're thrown back into a workplace, perhaps not even by choice, but mm-hmm. perhaps by choice, which isn't supporting them, how are they going to get better? How are they going to, you know, be able to offer their talents when they have them to their colleagues if they're not supported?
Yeah, I mean, what we see is, unfortunately, if they don't feel they're supported, they are supported, they leave. And that's why we're seeing this huge female talent flight at these big corporations. So what I've seen, and this is also fascinating, women like me who leave corporate and start their own company, we're not unique at all. So when a woman doesn't feel supported by her manager or doesn't feel supported by her team, she'll leave and she'll do her own thing. And what's fascinating is we see these women start their own businesses and actually become kind of competitors to their old firms. And that's fun for me to say as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting. But then you end up with a lack of the voices that are needed in those corporations to make the changes to avoid women leaving those roles.
Totally. And we all need more female entrepreneurs, but we also need women to stay in corporate and to thrive in their corporate jobs as well.
Right. And I think it's phenomenal if we think about how difficult it is to set up your own business. That is easier for women to do than remaining in their jobs, which they already had and were already doing. But it's made so difficult for them to do their job after having a baby.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to kind of see what keeps women, and this is something I've been working on in my own research, is how what keeps women working and what motivates them to stay. And the degree of social support by either their direct manager or fellow colleagues has way more bearing on their likelihood to stay than an increase in pay, promotion, and all these other kind of normal kind of incentives that one would think would move the needle. They actually really don't for moms.
Yeah, it's that sense of community, I think, that it's sort of that element of it takes a village, but like the village, your workplace has to be part of that village.
Absolutely.
Now, part of this, I mean, looking at young children and also, you know, juggling it with my wife, it's childcare. I mean, that's a big, I think that's the principal challenge for our country, is that we just don't have that childcare system support that most other countries, especially in Europe, do, which enables, it's just much more accepted that affordable childcare is an option, whereas now it's very expensive and it's something that many people are choosing to drop out of the workforce because it's just not worth it. They're not making enough money in order to do both. So I think that's a huge part of the puzzle.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because the way that I advise couples in regards to whether or not mom or even dad drops out of the workforce because childcare costs are so incredibly high, is what I normally see with couples is they'll take the cost of childcare. Let's say it's just, we're making up numbers here, 50 grand. Let's say mom's salary is 55 grand a year. So they come to this conclusion, we're net 5K a year. This is not worth it, right? But I view that kind of the way that framework works as very limiting. So what I suggest to couples, because yes, childcare costs are obscenely high in the United States, is to actually pool the aggregate family income And then find out what childcare costs as a percentage of that. So, because it's not just about the 1 year, 2 years that mom's not working. We're talking about lost wages over the course of her career. And we all know how hard it is to re-enter after being out for so long. So I actually find that that framework where you're coming at it also as like a couple's finances instead of just mom's finances, which because the gender pay gap are typically, you know, lower right. than dad's, is much more productive and helpful than just saying, oh, well, mom makes as much as childcare costs, therefore she should stay home.
Jenna, in the last third of the show here, we want to talk a bit about how what the church is doing to help women with postpartum depression and what more can be done. So maybe you can talk a little bit about your experience in that regard.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been very lucky to really benefit from an incredible number. It's really been that it's been so many of communities within my faith that were really incredible support systems for me. And when I was going through postpartum depression, so actually I really exhibited symptoms while I was pregnant. And I knew that there was something was up. I was like, I'm going to go on a retreat. And I went on a Caris retreat, which is a young adult retreat that's led by a community in New York City. I'd been on a bunch of them before. And it really just gave me the space to pray about what I was going through, all the changes situationally, physically, emotionally, and even spiritually to really like open up that space. So I think even though there's not a very obvious source for the church, for someone like me going through postpartum depression to be like, you know, I'm going to go to that area of the church to find help. But there's so many communities, and I really benefited from the communities I was part of within my faith community to help me through that.
Yeah. And I think that that's a really interesting point, because there's places where you can sort of reach out if you want to, but there for if you aren't already a part of a community, I think it's hard for a lot of women to find a place where it feels appropriate to talk about the difficulties of being of having postpartum depression and anxiety, and even just of like the difficulties of being a mother, being a parent. I talked to a lot of women for the article who feel like that. A lot of pressure because of both our society's expectations for women and this image, the value that the church places on motherhood, which is great. It's important that mothers are valued in the church. But I think a lot of women felt this expectation that you have to be a specific kind of mother, or you have to always just be 100% filled with joy at every task that you do as a mother, or that they had to be, you know, like Mary in a way that was implied a perfection that they didn't feel, rather than like Mary in a way that implied sort of acceptance of God's will. And because I think a lot of women had this sense of worrying that they didn't live up to those expectations. And that can be really hard when you're going to like a mom's group. One of the women I talked to said, oh, she went to a mom's group and was like, yeah, I have postpartum depression, and was sort of met with like crickets. Like, this is awkward. We love being moms. What's wrong with you? You know, like this mm-hmm. sense of that there must be something sort of like fundamentally wrong with someone who might feel this way and have this particular illness.
I actually think, and this is true of postpartum depression, but also kind of all types of mental health problems. When people don't have a name to put on what they're feeling, sometimes the first thing they go to is, oh, this is a spiritual feeling. I should be praying harder. I should be doing something more in my faith life to make this go away. And it's an illness. It can't be prayed away in that sense. And that's another obstacle to get past in order to find treatment
yeah.
and to get better, and also to find the language to talk about the experience.
Yeah, a lot of the women I spoke to mentioned that. And one of them said that she said to her, there was a doctor, a counselor, like, you know, I feel like this is a spiritual failing, you know, like I'm not praying hard enough or something. And she said, would you feel like it was a spiritual failing if you needed an appendicitis, you know, or if you had appendicitis? And she's like, no. And she's like, well, this is a similar sort right. of physical thing happening to your body, that helped her to put that in perspective. Do you find talking to women that they are challenged by their faith or to find community in their faith?
I would say it's mixed. I think that women that, especially, I mean, we also have to, I like to think about this part of one's life at a very specific time in their faith journey. So, you know, typically women that are, you know, first-time mothers, late 20s, 30s, maybe 40s, you've gotten to a point where you're settled in your career, you have a community of friends, probably have a church that you consistently go to. You probably, if you've lived there in that city for a while, you've met people, you've had community. So, you know, I would say that it's a different situation if someone that's just graduating out of college, totally relocating. But for a lot of the women that I know, that they've been actively part of their communities for some time. So there is that dialogue. And I do think that the church overall is much more welcoming, you know, frankly, in my situation than some of my secular friends when it comes to mental health challenges. A lot of the hurdles that I went through and some of the shame that I experienced around my diagnosis, I actually confided in fellow Catholics, not so much the friends I grew up with since I was five. It was kind of interesting in that way. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like I would be received by this group of people in this specific community, and I was.
That's actually part of, you mentioned this in your article, Carrie, that the church and church faith communities are really good when they work well at helping support people going through mental distress or mental health problems. And so that's why the women that you feature in your article, Carrie, are working hard to kind of harness that power that's already there to make it even easier for that good work to be done.
But yeah, we've spoken on the show before about, you know, reaching out to people in the parish with some sort of disability. And some of those disabilities can be often invisible. And this, like, mental illness would fall in that. And so the challenge becomes how do you reach out if, A, you don't know somebody's suffering, and B, sometimes people won't even, you know, they won't come to church because, you know, they've got kids and it's maybe it doesn't make sense to try to take your baby to church. So suddenly the outreach becomes that more important. So to get, you know, to find them rather than waiting for them to come to you. So I don't know, Carrie, if you talk to people
of the women that I spoke with helped to found a chapter of the Elizabeth Ministry at her parish, which I had not heard of till I started researching this. And this takes on different forms. It's not always a chapter of the Elizabeth Ministry, but I've heard of it at other parishes, which is sort of a ministry among mothers to mothers. And the idea of this is that you are sort of, they have individuals reaching out to other individuals who might have similar experiences. So you can talk sort of one-on-one to somebody. It's not an official counseling relationship, but it's that invitation, it's that connection. And what they do often is they have, like, a couple times a year pregnancy blessings. So anyone who is pregnant in the parish can come up and have a blessing for a safe and healthy pregnancy. And then they learn who the people are that are in this process. They learn, they can make a connection with them then. They can reconnect with them at baptism. They can reconnect with them if it turns out that the pregnancy ends with, you know, a stillbirth or a miscarriage. They're already connected to somebody and can connect those women with people who might have experienced the same thing. So I think it's what has been successful at parishes is the outreach from, like, way before people give birth or start families. And it was some of the women talked about when women come in for, you know, families come in to have their kids baptized, that is a really important point for contact for clergy who might learn about these symptoms, who might check in with families and say, you know, how are you doing? Do you know we have this mom's group? Oh, are you experiencing this? Here's a brochure even, you know, a way to kind of outreach for people who, you know, I think there's still, like, a fair number of people who get their kids baptized and then kind of, like, just don't go back for a while. You know, like, they're like, yeah, my mom wants this to happen or whatever. And they do it. And that might be the only time the church has a chance to reach out to them. And that could be a really important point of contact. So there's a number of ways that it can be done. But it usually, as you point out, has to start often before someone sort of starts their family or gives birth.
Well, it sounds like this one-on-one contact, this Elizabeth Ministry. I mean, there's a range of issues that young mothers face. I mean, this is one obviously major one, but from everything like, oh, how am I going to adjust to life, you know, on my own if I'm now home from work, or, you know, just having groups to bring your baby to, all those things, like especially first time mothers.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the groups, like, they'll make meals for the women and just stop by and like bring a meal and have a point of contact, like just talking to like an adult human is like sometimes just like a relief. It doesn't, you don't have to talk about anything. It's just like, I have been, you know, in this house with someone who is just crying or like wanting things of me for like hours on end. And now we're having a conversation, and that can be just such a relief. What advice would you have, Jenna? We have a few minutes left for new moms trying to transition into their role as mothers.
Oh, where to begin?
Yeah, okay. You've got 3 minutes.
You have 2 minutes to sum this up.
Okay. So I think one would be to really pray, be very honest about your desires and your longings and your fears. I find that especially once women are pregnant or even after they've given birth, like all of that goes to the wayside, where you kind of become this mommy martyr, and my desires and what I want for my life all, you know, just kind of disappears. So to have that dialogue, and especially in your prayer, because you really have the freedom to tell God exactly what you want, or to even ask questions where, I mean, I had this question happen all the time in my prayer life, like, where do you want me to go with my life right now? This is, my career was massively turned on its head. I'm now a mom. What's next? So that would be one thing. The second thing would be to really enhance support systems. What I see, especially in New York City, parents of mothers are very far away. No one really lives in that village type of community anymore. So traditional support systems such as grandparents, aunts, uncles, they may not be there. So you're going to have to create your own support system. That may be other mommy friends, the church community, but beefing that up is absolutely critical. And then three, especially in regards to postpartum depression, is to really make sure you evaluate your symptoms. And I also really recommend it's an app. It's called ACT. It's run by UNC. And what it is it's a little app on your phone that asks you a series of questions that evaluate your postpartum symptoms. And I definitely recommend everyone to download that and to see where they stand.
Well, thank you so much, Jenna. Thanks for all the good work you do for women, for the church, for the workplace, you know, the world.
No problem.
Well done. So for folks who are looking for more resources, in addition to the app, there is postpartum.net, which is Postpartum Support International's website, where you can find local resources and counseling. There's the National Coalition of Maternal Mental Health, ncmmh.org. There's babiesonthebrain.com, which is Jenna's organization. And there's also an awareness project called the bluedotproject.org, which can help raise awareness of these issues. So please go to some of these websites if you are in need of help, in need of assistance, and hopefully these will be of use to you. So thanks guys for talking about this. I know it's not easy.
No, well, it's an important topic, and I'm glad. I hope we can provide some help to our listeners who might be going through this.
And May is maternal mental health month.
And we should also say, if you're not experiencing any of these symptoms, but you know new parents, new mothers, reach out, because it makes a real difference.
Makes a huge difference.
Indeed. Yes. So thank you very much for listening to us, as always. We invite you to subscribe to our magazine. You can go to americamagazine.org for America This Week. I am Carrie Weber, joined by Tim Reedy and Eloise Blondio. Thanks for listening this week.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.